Just to note that in this episode, Richard is going to talk about his young son dying from cancer and the impact of that traumatic experience on his mental health. He also describes how climbing has helped him recover and manage his PTSD. If those issues affect you, we've got details of Child Bereavement UK in the show notes and episode description. And if you need to talk to someone, you can always call Samaritans anytime, day or night, on 116 123. Finding Our Way is proudly sponsored by Berghaus, a team of people united by their passion for the outdoors and who are working hard to create more diversity in the sports we love. For more detailed information, go and have a look at the episode description.
Hello, I'm Marianne Ohotta and welcome to Finding Our Way, the podcast from the British Mountaineering Council, aka the BMC, all about diversifying the voices we normally hear talking about the outdoors. In each episode, we talk to someone who's usually busy climbing, mountaineering or walking and find out what they've learned from their adventures and perhaps explore what the rest of us could learn from them too. There's good chat, memorable stories and hopefully bursts of inspiration from people who are making real change happen. Okay, so today joining us is a climber and mountaineer who's changing the way trauma is treated in mainstream healthcare. He's at the forefront of new NHS trials of so-called social prescribing, where patients can be offered non-medical, often community-based interventions. Your doctor, for example, telling you to go climbing. Research shows it can lead to positive improvements for someone's health, which may be no surprise to our listeners who are already apostles of the climbing faith. The reason this man got into the work is because of his own journey through trauma and how he himself uses climbing and mountaineering to help him cope with personal tragedy. Connecting with us from Nottingham, welcome Richard Chapman. Hello.
Hello there, Marianne. Nice to meet you. Thanks for having me on.
I'm very, very, very interested to have this conversation with you and learn more about your story. Okay, so first of all, tell me, what is your background with climbing and mountaineering? How did you get into it?
It started, I guess, like a lot of people, with my dad. My dad was in the Navy and they did lots of kind of adventure training type things. And when I was about 8, he dragged me on one of the walks in Brecon Beacons. And the first mountain I ever climbed was Penavan. And I remember doing it in my school shoes, my Clark Commando school shoes, and being very pretty proud of myself.
As you should be, quite
absolutely.
Right.
I remember giving him some advice, sort of saying, watch out, Dad, it's a bit steep here. And that really sort of started a love affair with it. I remember I also went on a PGL holiday when I was about 9 and discovered a bit of abseiling, a bit of canoeing, and I thought, oh, I really like this. I grew up in the far west of Cornwall, so I was born in Penzance and I grew up right down the far end. And one of the teachers at my secondary school, a guy called Pete Jones, was a climber, and he would take some of the lads from my school climbing at the weekends with the Land's End Climbing Club. Big Cornish sea cliffs, very intimidating places. You learn good rope work and you learn how to climb together. And it became a sort of real passion for me and my life. We did lots of hill walking on Dartmoor and the 10 tours and letterboxing, things like that. And then when I was about 15, I think my dad drove myself and my best mate to North Wales. That was a hell of a journey. That's like 10 hours in his battered old Ford Escort, you know, all the way up the A5. I remember there being a truck stop somewhere and we had a massive pine chips. And then we arrived in the Ogwen Valley in the middle of the night and me and my friend John had our sort of faces pressed to the car window trying to get a glimpse of these mountains that we'd heard of and read about in Climber magazine. And then the next day, you know, getting up and just going, wow, you know, we've arrived. Look, there's Trevann. Oh my goodness, you know, just absolutely mind-blowing.
It's amazing, isn't it? That experience of turning up somewhere at night and kind of feeling the darkness and enormousness of the mountains around you.
Yeah, there's just a change in scale. That was the thing I realised. And Trevann, I'd heard about it and seen pictures of it, and it's like this sort of this dinosaur back of a hill. And when you see it in real life, you think, oh, that's just, you know, that is, I want to be up there. You can feel the presence around you when it's dark. And the interesting thing about scale is as I got older and you know, then you then go to Scotland and then we did some sort of winter climbing up there. I went to university in Leeds, so lots of gritstone climbing. Eventually I made it down to the Alps. And again, that change of scale, you know, what looks massive in Scotland and North Wales is just kind of the foothills, or it's just the first bit of the walk. It's just to get up to the hut in the Alps, and then the climbing starts. When you have young kids, you sort of, you don't get as much opportunity to climb as much as you'd like to, certainly as much as you used to. And I did take it did tail off a little bit when the kids were younger. But as they start to get older, you start taking them with you. And I now got, all my kids now have been climbing and walking, and we've been to Skye, and we used to go to Aviemore every year. And it's kind of a natural part of our family life. They love being in the outdoors. And it's a real kind of real privilege to be able to pass that on to them and just see their sort of amazement and interest and love of the outdoors grow as well.
You've described, though, that you should be passing on this love of the outdoors to one more person. Explain that.
So this is where the story sort of takes a bit of a slightly darker turn. And it's interesting when you listen to people or meet people the first time, you can sort of have preconceptions about them, or you make assumptions about them. You don't know anything about them, really. You don't know anything about the burden that people carry or the challenges they've faced. Because as you say, I should be passing my experience, my love, on to one more person. My first child, my first child was born in 1997, but he died of a very rare brain tumour in 1998. So he was 14 months old. I then went on to have four more children, but that sort of story of the child that I had and then lost is something that I don't normally tell people about. It's not a thing I'm used to talking about. I've never felt it's something that people need to hear about, and it's certainly nothing I'd ever thought I would talk about publicly. It's not a sort of inspirational story, or it doesn't have a happy ending or any sort of sense of redemption. I've never really been sure that my story is worth telling. It always felt like nobody's business but ours, and my wife and ours. And I felt for a long time that people are generally better off not knowing about the injustice, the anger, the hopelessness of child loss. It's not a story that people really need to hear, I felt.
Do you feel like it's that they didn't need to hear it, or that they didn't want to hear it, or that you didn't want to share it because you don't want to go there and rehash it time and time again?
Yeah, I think there's all those and more, probably. I mean, my wife and I speak about it, but only very occasionally, and only when we're both ready, emotionally. We don't speak about it because it was immensely traumatic in every sense of the word, and intensely private. We've never really seen any benefit from telling other people. All it does is cause us massive pain and probably elicit lots of sympathy, neither of which we really want. So we do keep it for our own protection, and indeed other people's. I mean, experience has told us that telling other people can be very difficult for them. I remember telling one of my friends, Rob. He'd asked me, how are things going, and this is when Archie was ill, and I said, it's terminal. And the poor guy's legs buckled, and he nearly fell down the stairs that we were walking down, because it's very, very powerful information, and it tends to hit people quite hard. It leaves them, a bit dumbstruck or grasping for unhelpful cliches. There's not a lot of people can say or do that makes them or us feel any better, and it doesn't change anything. It's also very exposing, as you say. It makes me very vulnerable, and when I meet new people, I don't talk about it. In fact, if the conversation starts to go to places where it might become a topic of conversation, I try and divert it. I have to be very careful with people who ask kind of slightly more probing questions, because I have to sort of judge at some point when I make a new friend or a work colleague. I have to judge, am I going to tell this person? And if so, how and when? You have to be sensitive to your own emotions and to other people's. It's those emotional kind of feelings are burned into the brain, and if I engage with them, if I drift there, if I let them resurface, it's like touching a live wire or putting your hand in something that's too hot. You just recoil in pain, and so I try not to. I try not to engage with them. It's too dangerous. The impact of those memories and that experience lessened over time, but the sort of sudden temper outbursts of punching walls, throwing furniture, poor sleep, invasive thoughts, which are, you know, visions of really unpleasant things, normally horrendous injuries to one of my other children, they all add up. And they all add up to something that is recognisable as post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And knowing that I have that, you have to be quite aware of how those emotions can control you.
Did you get that diagnosis soon after your loss? Or is that something that you've discovered many years down the line?
It's something I've discovered many years down the line. We reached out for help when our second child was quite young. I mean, I think she was maybe one or two, and I was really struggling. So we reached out for help with for counselling, and what I thought was counselling, and it ended up in a meeting with two or three other people. I don't know who they were, but it became clear during the conversation that this wasn't counselling. I was being assessed to see if I was a danger to my children. These were sort of social worker types. We've tried sort of grief counselling, but the problem is, When you talk about it and you feel your way down into the emotions, as I said, it's so powerful and overwhelming that you just kind of you can't go there. You can't get into it from talking down into it. And so it's only after kind of 20, 22 years, and actually some of the work I've started to do with the NHS helped me kind of uncover what might be going on. It's more than grief. It is trauma.
Okay. Tell me about how climbing and mountaineering and your passion for the outdoors, how has that come into this mix? How has it perhaps helped you?
In the last few years, I started to see more and more stories in the papers about the health benefits of being in the outdoors. And there were a few groups. I think Mountains for the Mind, I think, is run by Berghaus and a magazine. There's a few kind of walking groups and things like this where it just started to allow me to reflect a little bit on my love of the outdoors and what it did for me. And I used to think about it in three broad buckets, the sort of the physical, the psychological and the emotional. Physically, climbing is great exercise, and everyone knows that exercise is good for you, all the endorphins and all that great stuff. And so that is true. And psychologically, there's a lot of evidence now that being in nature generally is good for you. And I've come across some work from a professor at the University of Derby called Miles Richardson. He's doing some work with Natural England, looking at a thing called the nature connection or nature connectedness. It's a thing. You can measure your relationship with nature, how you think about, feel about and experience nature. And when we're very close to nature, we recognise ourselves as part of it, and you feel very connected to it, and you value your own relationship with it. And what Professor Richardson's work's done is he's shown that people with high nature connectedness are, I think it's like 1.7 times more likely to report that their lives are worthwhile. So just by feeling part of nature, you feel more valued and more valuable yourself. So physically it's good for you, psychologically it's good for you. I wanted to get into the emotional side of it, because it felt much deeper and more fundamental than just, you know, getting a bit of a sweat on while looking at a nice view. It's more than that. I have to say, I was a bit worried that I was a sample of one, and actually a highly biased or privileged one at that, you know, middle class, straight white man. You know, there's lots of those that go climbing. I needed some sort of external validation that it was relevant and authentic and had a basis in fact, this connection.
Right, okay, so you're not going, turns out this is great and it makes me feel great, everyone should do it. Not that simple.
I don't think so, no. And I didn't want it to be that simple, because otherwise, it is just a matter of circumstance or what have you. And I wanted this to be something that had the credibility that the health service and mental health care and all those other sort of more serious sort of bodies can look at and understand and recognise. Because if you're going to design care pathways and you're going to fund stuff, you need to have a basis of kind of scientific fact, if you like, to sort of say, no, this is real. I wanted to see what is the sort of neurological basis, if you like, of recovery, because emotions are just, you know, things in the brain, so there must be some connection. And I haven't quite worked out whether it is specific to climbing, because I haven't been able to kind of experience other things that have caused it. But I know that the things I've experienced in climbing definitely have this basis. And actually, it was a book that I found a couple of years ago called The Body Keeps the Score, which is written by a US psychiatrist called Bessel van der Kolk. He explained this neurological basis for it, and you have to understand a little bit about trauma in the brain and things. So there is the old bit of the brain, which you don't really know about. It's the bit that keeps you breathing and your heart pumping and digestion system working and helps you stand upright. That's just kind of the autonomous bit. You don't worry about it. There's a bit just above that, which is sort of the quite an old part of the brain. I think it's called the reptilian brain or the limbic brain. And that's where all your emotions are processed. So it kind of it assesses where you are and how you're feeling and what's going on, and sort of it assimilates all the incoming signals and sends it up to the top bit of the brain, which is your, you know, the bit you can see, the neocortex, that sort of foldy bit. And that bit of the brain then interprets those signals and makes decisions on what you should and shouldn't do as a result of what you're feeling. So that connection between how you're feeling and what you do about it is a really, really important sort of principle to understand how trauma affects the brain and actually how climbing overcomes it. So when you experience something traumatic, the emotions that are created are enormously overwhelming and overpowering. So that sort of reptilian brain is firing out messages saying, this is unpleasant, I'm not enjoying this, I'm in deep, deep distress, get me out of here, this is horrible. One of the things that makes an experience traumatic is you can't do anything about it. So it's firing these signals up to the top part of the brain, and the top part of the brain says, I know, but my child's dying and I can't stop it, or I'm in a war zone and I can't get out, or whatever it is. You can't get the body away from the stimulus. So the stimulus just keeps going and going and going and becomes incredibly overpowering. And that is one of the sort of big differences, if you like, between kind of trauma and grief, for example. You can't get away from it. The other thing about it is those memories are, and those sense, those sort of the perspectives your brain has, they don't change over time. Most memories that we have, they soften over time. They sort of, you know, merge a little bit, and it becomes a bit blurry, and you're not quite, you know, it all becomes a little bit hazy, and you start to kind of confuse things a little bit. Traumatic memories don't change. They are strong, powerful. They are just as raw and primal as the moment that you had them. They don't soften over time.
So does that mean that if something that reminds you of your son or those experiences, you feel it as strongly and as vividly as you did the first time? It's not a kind of nostalgic, that's the wrong word, but a kind of, like you say, slightly hazy, that happened a long time ago. Oh yeah, that was bad then.
You're absolutely right. And what you're talking about is being triggered, right? So one of the aspects that the sort of that reptilian brain, that the limbic brain, it's super sensitive to anything that reminds it of those times. It could be a smell, it could be a sound, it could be, you know, a photograph, or whatever it is. The brain is super, super sensitive and is constantly scanning for it. And if it gets a slight whiff of it, bang, the alarms go off and wallop. You're suddenly in the corner sobbing. That's called being triggered. And you're absolutely right. The memories are so, so powerfully vivid and rich that, you know, there are particular smells and particular sounds and particular sensations that, you know, again, if I allow myself into it, they are still there and they're still very, very raw. So that understanding of where a traumatic memory sits and the sort of higher parts of the brain that interacts with it was the first kind of clue that I started to look into in this book. The second thing that I found out was that because those powerful memories are so distressing and so disturbing, you know, it's not great. It's not a great outcome for you if every time you're triggered or you smell something, you end up in a crumpled heap in the corner. So what the cortex does, it does this clever little trick where it cuts off the neural networks between it and the old part of the brain. It basically stops the neural pathways from working. And it doesn't do it in a particularly intelligent way. It can't, like, shut down all the bad feelings and keep all the good ones. It shuts them all down. And what that does is it ends up with you being, you know, emotionless, kind of almost cold and distant from things. That's a protective mechanism that the brain puts in place. It shuts down those neural networks because it doesn't want to feel those emotions.
That's a huge burden to carry. Not only that feeling that you can't go to all these places in life or in the richness of feeling those emotions because it's too dangerous. You're also carrying this secret of what happened to you and your wife and your family because you don't want other people to see it or talk to them about it.
Yes, I mean, it's sort of, there's a perspective about you, yes, we carry our burden, and there are a lot of people who carry very difficult things around with them. When we think about how we've lived our lives with our children, it has ended up being, it's ended up being very kind of intimate and very quite short-termist. We've basically lived our lives almost week by week just with them because that we didn't take anything for granted. We knew what can happen, and so we've never been able to kind of plan long-term or kind of, you know, think about the future and things like this. They're just sort of things that you could be knocked down by a bus tomorrow, so let's get on and enjoy today. You know, it's very, very short-termist. And that's actually, sometimes that's not a bad way of living. You know, it's actually okay.
Loads of memes on social media encouraging us to kind of, you know, live life to the max and seize the day, seize the moment. Yeah. And that being a kind of source of freedom. But I guess if that's actually a protective mechanism, then perhaps it's not as enriching and as freeing as perhaps you might look at.
It can come across as sort of quite nice and inspiring, you know, YOLO and all that sort of nonsense. It's also quite naive, you know, life is long. And you sort of, you know, on the whole, life is long. You do need to confront some difficult things. It's not all about having a good time. There's a great TED talk done by a lady called Susan David, who's a South African psychologist, I think. She talks about how difficult emotions, I think she says, discomfort is the price of admission to a meaningful life. That's the quote she has, which is lovely. It's from her book, Emotional Agility. So you have to be able to engage with difficult things because that's part of being alive. Right. And if you can't, then you're missing out on a big part of being alive. And I think that's a kind of a really insightful thought. Life isn't all ha ha he he, to quote Mira Sayal. One of the things, you know, going back to the book, towards the end of the book, Bas van der Kolk talks about things you can do about it. And there's a really interesting thing. He talked about kind of therapy, talking therapy, where if you try and talk down into your trauma, it doesn't work. And I said, yeah, you're right, it doesn't. Because, as I said, it's too raw. But what he has shown is that if you allow people to experience emotion with a source, if you like, a kind of specific emotional stimulus, and then give them the space to rationalize about it, you actually can reconnect your emotions to your higher part of the brain. You can rewire the brain. You can kickstart those neural networks again. He talks about it in terms of yoga. So the whole point of yoga is to connect with the body. How am I feeling? And then to sort of reach sort of transcendental state above that kind of thing. And he's shown that. Now, I don't do yoga, so I was like, okay, next. Then he talked about theatre and actually using veterans and people with post-traumatic stress to do some theatre work, because in theatre you have to pretend to be someone who's got an emotion, and the best way of doing that is to show the emotional side of your character is to experience that emotion, but in a very controlled environment. So you might want to experience anger or love or hate or what have you as a character, and then of course you can talk about it and rationalise afterwards. And actually, because you're feeling a genuine emotion, you're starting to reconnect the emotional parts of the brain to the higher part of the brain.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, and the final one he talked about was singing, choir, going to swing, because, and you know, I don't know if you sing, but being in music has this incredibly emotive sort of side of it, and I certainly, you know, if Frank Turner's playing in Nottingham, I'll be down the front singing my heart out with, you know, a couple of other thousand people and having an emotionally transformative experience, because it does create these emotional experiences which you can then understand and you can then rationalise and reflect upon, and that is the action that recreates the connections between the higher parts of the brain and the emotional parts of the brain.
And when you say rationalise about it, what is that kind of a, I'm going to sit down and think about my experiences just now, or does that happen organically?
I think you have to give yourself the opportunity to reflect and think on it. That the actual action will happen automatically. If you have an emotional experience, you know, your brain does recognise it and you think, I feel great. But actually going that extra step to say, I feel great because I did that and that made me feel like this, and isn't that interesting? It's just the next little heave. Now, I've been very privileged to be able to spend the last 2 years or so thinking about how this works for me and how climbing creates certain emotional kind of, or it demands certain emotional sort of reactions and states, which I can then reflect upon. So that's where I suddenly get, okay, well, maybe this is what we need to be helping people understand.
Ooh, okay, so we've got yoga next, theatre next, singing. Tell me about climbing.
Yeah, climbing, I think there's a huge amount of emotion involved in climbing. You know, you can't really deny the effort, the concentration, the joy, the frustrations, all the stuff that climbing comes with being a climber, being a mountaineer. So what I set about doing was trying to identify, okay, well, let's be as specific as I can about what are these emotional states that climbing demands and what I do about it as a result, how it benefits sort of my brain, if you like, as a result. And I've come up with seven. Now, I haven't validated these yet, but they sort of reflect the climbing journey, if you like. So the first one is, it's actually all about planning and preparation and thinking ahead, sort of forcing you to think on a different time scale. Climbing doesn't happen by accident, right? Unless you've made some very bad choices. You have to be curious about what the future might hold and be willing to think through what might happen. That sort of actively gives you something to look forward to, something that lifts your head out of the daily sort of grind, if you like. It's not about being stuck where you are. It's about learning about what this new place might be like and going somewhere new and trying a new route or climbing a new mountain or what have you. Actually, that gives you something to look forward to, something really interesting. And you can have, you know, you might have heard the expression growth mindset. Really, I don't know. Let's go and find out. It's that curiosity. For somebody like me, where I haven't been thinking ahead very much at all, actually giving myself the chance to look ahead and think, okay, well, let's go and find out what might happen. That's a really interesting and sort of powerful learning. The second one's about commitment. This is about, you know, at some point you'll have to bite the bullet, you know, get out the car, do that route there, you know, commit yourself to the environment. And that creates a certain level of doubt and dread, and sort of, you know, am I good enough to be here? But by the more you do it, the more you practice it, the more you believe you can, and you have to silence that sort of inner judge to overcome that doubt. And it's actually about belief that, no, I'm not going to listen to that irrational part of my brain that says, I don't want to be here, you know, you can't do this or what have you. No, I have done stuff like this and I can do it. And if I don't like it, I can turn around and come back again. And that leads on to the third thing, which is about decision-making. The outdoors and the mountains, they're not a natural place for people to be. You're quite vulnerable when you're there, but actually recognising that vulnerability is the thing that keeps you safe, because it enforces you to make decisions about where you should be, where you should go, what you should do. And that gives you agency. That makes sure that says that you are in charge of your destiny. You can influence the outcome, nothing else. It's a really empowering kind of idea that you can make decisions for the better. The next one is about danger, and actually, it can feel quite frightening. Some of these places, you'll feel fear, but a lot of the dangers are perceived ones, and you have to be able to tell the difference between perceived risks and real risks, and acknowledging what is a risk and what isn't, and having that sense of perspective that says, yeah, okay, there is a massive drop over there, but, you know, it's fine, it's over there and I'm over here, I don't worry about that. It's a sort of, it's a real perspective shift, and actually being able to tease apart what's a real threat from just a threat that your brain has been sensitized to. Again, it's a really powerful, really powerful, empowering idea. Linked to that is the idea, is the fifth one, which is about exposure. I don't know if you've ever had that sort of sudden grip, you know, the expression being gripped, a sudden rush of panic that you just think, I'm absolutely terrified about where I am.
I have that regularly when forced to go climbing.
Okay, yeah, so you know that feeling.
Going, oh my God, what am I doing up here? This isn't normal or right.
Yeah, exactly. And the way out of it is focus. Is focus on the thing that's right in front of you, the thing you're standing on, the thing you're holding on to. That is the thing that's keeping you safe. That is the thing that means you're not actually in any danger. Just focus on the thing you're in. Be really rationalise it, and you realise that, again, you're in control. It's not the environment controlling you. You can get yourself out of this. And that sort of kind of, again, that sudden that agency says, you know, I can do this. And just the focus, you might call it mindfulness, but just the real kind of, what is the thing that really matters? It matters what I'm holding on to, nothing else. And that, again, is a lovely sort of idea. And the last two, one is isolation. Being out on your own can feel quite lonely and quite isolating, but actually that's part of the point of being out there. It can suddenly resolve itself as being a very intimate place. If you're with a climbing partner or a best friend, you can find a certain inner peace. And going back to the nature connectedness thing, if you are out in the environment, you suddenly realise that interconnectedness of your life with your climbing partner, with the world around you, with the civilised world back home, if you like. It's all part of the same thing. And actually, you're not isolated. You're intimately involved in it. You're part of it. You're not standing alone. And that leads you onto the last one, which is about learning. And actually learning about, well, sometimes you might not get to the top. You know, sometimes you have a horrible day in the hills and you feel a bit inadequate, or you're not good enough, or you know, you've kind of not climbed as well as you wanted to, or as well as other people, or what have you, and you might feel like a bit of a failure. But with the honest reflection, says what failure isn't, and actually what being good enough means. Because if you are good enough to go out there and try it and come back safely and go again another day, that's a success, right? That's winning. If you don't have a good day, it doesn't mean you never go back again. And it creates a much more, what I call, an authentic self-perception. So I perceive myself as a climber, and I'll go and I'll try stuff, and sometimes it'll work, and sometimes it won't. I don't perceive myself as being a world-beating climber, kind of amazing. I'm not, and it doesn't matter. It's kind of an authentic recognition of myself that you get from reflecting on what you've done, what you've achieved, what you're capable of, and it doesn't matter if you haven't climb Mont Blanc or whatever. It's, I've been out in that environment. I got absolutely, you know, blasted by the wind and the rain and the hail, and I'm back now, and I'm warm and toasty, and it was amazing. It's that sort of learning about what is failure and what isn't that can make you feel really good about being out there.
Has doing this work, has that changed how you climb yourself? You know, sort of that being in the front of your mind that this is now work that you're involved with as well?
I think it does. It changes the choice of what I do. So, for example, I've always loved scrambling, but I suddenly decided that rope scrambling is this lovely sort of mixture of formal climbing and all the techniques of gear placements and belaying and all that stuff you need, and being in really, really impressive mountains. And it's this fabulous combination. So, yeah, I've suddenly started seeking out really, really good scrambling lines. So one of the photos I've sent you is Dolman Ridge, which is on the north face of Glyndwr in Snowdonia. I've got Sky Cullen, I've got Sky Scrambles, I've got Highland Scrambles South, I've got Highland Scrambles North, I've got Scrambles in Snowdonia. And the other great thing is that I can take the kids with me on this. because they're, you know, the youngest is 17 and they love it. And I took my best mate and his youngest, his eldest, to the Lake District 2 years ago. We did, it was just before lockdown, to do Pinnacle Ridge on St. Sunday Crag, which is a fabulous scramble. And yeah, it's changed. I used to be a little bit about, I want to do the best, you know, I want to go to the best climbing spots and all the rest of it. And now it's actually, I want to find the most beautiful line, and just it's a much more aesthetic sort of side of it to me now.
And a bit more about journeying, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, it is. It's about, you know, if you can do it so that you come from here and then you and you end up there and you come back all the way down, it's not just cragging and it's not just sort of blitzing your way through it. There's actually that much more holistic sort of sense of it, because again, you have to plan a bit more carefully about what you're going to take. You have to think about the weather a bit more. You have to kind of just, as you say, just be a lot more holistic in a bit. And that's definitely a change. It might also that I'm getting old and I can't do the hard climbs anymore, but that's, you know, that's...
Is there something, though, Rich, in people who've experienced something traumatic or are in a vulnerable place in terms of their mental health? Perhaps sometimes going and seeking those activities where there is objective risk, where there is real danger. I don't know about you, but I can think of a few people that I know who are mountaineers or climbers, and you kind of go, ooh, the choices you sometimes make or the way that you approach this risk or this situation isn't one that makes me feel particularly comfortable, because I think that they're coming from a place where it's sort of a bit destabilized and kind of, I've got nothing to live for. It doesn't matter if I die or get hurt. And it's actually coming from a kind of a place of distress rather than empowerment.
Yeah.
Have you experienced that? Do you know what I mean?
I can certainly recognize it. And I think the when I was talking with a lady who runs a mental health service here in Nottingham, and I said, look, I'm really interested in the restorative power of climbing. Can we have a conversation, or can you have a conversation with you know, the sort of the leaders, the managers and healthcare leaders in the group? And she said, yeah, that sounds amazing. So we talked about taking people to a climbing wall. There's a couple of climbing walls in Nottingham. One of them is more bouldering and one of them is more roped climbing. And they had a really interesting conversation, and the leaders of that service were saying, well, normally we wouldn't want to take someone who's got potentially you know, thoughts of self-harming very high up, you know, tied to a rope. It just doesn't feel like it's like the normal thing we would do. But I can absolutely see how it might work, because suddenly you're into the real nitty-gritty of, okay, well, how do we put in place the safeguarding? How do we put in place the clinical management of it and the long-term follow-up? Because you can't just expect someone to go to the climbing wall, tie on, boom, you're cured. It's a much more holistic thing than that. And yeah, it actually has to be part of a care pathway. And that's why, over the last sort of year or two, I've been trying to and engaging with several national and local groups to say, okay, if we're going to do this, how do we do it in a safe, responsible, clinically governable way that doesn't create that level of exposure, that has the right levels of governance and actually create something of value? So how do we do it in a way that as many people as possible can benefit from in a therapeutic and safe way as possible?
So, I referenced it in my introduction, the idea of a climbing prescription. You go to your GP and go, I'm not okay. And they go, you should go climbing. Here's a prescription. I mean, I know that's flippant, but tell me, how does it actually work? Or how will it work in the future if this all gets off the ground?
So this is coming out of some work led by, it was a friend of a friend who I met a few years ago called James Sanderson. He runs a thing called the National Academy of Social Prescribing. And one of his colleagues, a lady called Jo Fitzgerald, she runs the personalised care bit of NHS England. So they're looking at this thing called social prescribing, which is, as you said, a sort of non-medical community-based interventions for health and wellbeing. Something like one in five GP appointments are for sort of non-medical or more social concerns, and actually low mood or mental health worries is the number one kind of driver for those. So what James and Joe and their team have been doing is they've been placing into GP surgeries a new role, a new person called social prescribing link worker. And what they have is a network of, they understand of what is on offer in the local environment, what voluntary groups, what sports groups, what whoever is around that could offer a valuable service or offer to somebody with, you know, low mood or isolation or feelings of loneliness or what have you. So it's become, you know, I think there's supposed to be one in every GP surgery. It's obviously they're on the road. I think there's about 5,000 of them at the moment. And the providers. So in Nottingham, we have a scheme called Green Space, which is really looking at green social prescribing. So that is actually using nature-based activities as social prescribing routes. Providers can go on their database and they can say to the social prescribing link worker, you know, we do this and we can help with these kind of things. And then somebody who contacts the link worker can then be referred to them, and any sort of inherent costs like fees or insurance stuff, that's the sort of things that would be covered then by the prescription, if you like. What my sort of involvement in it is I'm trying to shape what those offers could be. A couple of years ago, I went on a course called the Peer Leadership Development Programme. This is an NHS England course that is designed to give people like me, who have got what's called lived experience, an opportunity to learn how to shape the NHS sort of service provision. It's not just done by doctors and nurses and psychiatrists. They want people with lived experience involved in the designing and commissioning of services. So I went on this course, and now I work with sort of local and national NHS groups to try and say, okay, well, what does that care pathway look like? Green Space, as I've mentioned, is a 2-year programme funded by central government. It involves lots of groups, so, you know, Department of Health and Social Care, Department of Environment, sort of DEFRA, Natural England, NHS England, all these different groups. Nottingham's got, I think, is one of 7 test and learn sites. They've got £500,000 and they're halfway through the trial at the moment. It's run by a local group called NCVS, Nottingham Community Voluntary Services. And they're looking at, okay, how do we build this network of link workers, of potential providers? They work quite closely with groups like the Canal and River Trust, because one of the activities, for example, one of our friends is involved in, is paddleboarding. So you can go to rock up down on the canals and the River Trent and go paddleboarding as part of a sort of social prescription.
And so, this is active now. So if any of our listeners are resident of Nottingham, they could contact their GP and say, this is something that I think I need. I mean, is that how it could work?
Yes, you should be able to, in our area, go and talk to your social prescribing link worker and say, look, this is what I'm struggling with. What can you help me with?
I imagine that some people might hear the idea of going climbing, going paddleboarding, going walking for health, gardening, whatever the green prescription activity is, and kind of saying, well, hang on a minute, I do that anyway. I've got a group of friends, or I'm a member of a club. That's what I do, but I just don't have it as a sort of a clinical treatment. I can see the benefits that I get from it. Why does it need to be formalised in this way, Richard? Are you not just making a job for yourself?
Yeah, I think there is a clear mandate for Green Spaces to use this, that the money they've got to reach out to underserved communities, to people who wouldn't normally be able to access these things. I mean, it's quite difficult for somebody who's living with something like post-traumatic stress or low mood, anxiety, to go into an environment that they're not familiar with. You couldn't just rock up at the climbing wall and go, hey, yeah, let's give this a crack. It's not a switch you can, you know, flip on and off. It's a care program, a pathway that we'll have to find ways of shaping it to that person's capability and capacity. So it's not just, right, we're going to go climb Ben Nevis next week. That's not the point. What is right for this person? In the personalised care element of NHS England's have this nice mantra. This is, it's no longer what's the matter with you, it's what matters to you. What can we do that's important for you that we can then help kind of, you know, your journey, your recovery. I don't think I'm as naive to think that you can take someone climbing and they'll be better. It's about the experience of connection and the emotional journey that it takes you on over, you know, a year, 2 years, whatever it is. And yes, the ideal outcome is by the end of it, this person who came in as a patient kind of can move on to, I'm now an integrated member of this climbing club. I've now have a group of friends who we go walking with. I've now have this connection that I've always had in my life and others like me have always have been lucky enough to have. That is part of my therapeutic journey. It's not just a case of, right, here's a £5 voucher to go climbing or something, because that's just a sticking plaster and it's not going to help.
And for you, do you think climbing has enabled you to recover from your trauma, or is it something more complicated, something more current than that?
I do think my story is one of recovery, really. I don't know that I would have said that certainly 10 years ago. And certainly when I started doing the program I mentioned, the Peer Leadership Development Program, one of the sort of most powerful elements of that is it gives you an opportunity to explore your story, And I did it with people who, there were carers for people with very, very complex needs, or their children had complex needs, or their partner. There was one guy on it who's just had his third kidney transplant. There were people with long-term health conditions, mental health problems, and me. And I'm sort of sat there going, am I in the right room? Is this a valid, an authentic experience? And actually, by explaining my story, I realised that I was only ever really focusing on the first half of the story, what happened to me and the trauma that it caused and how I've sort of struggled with that. And actually, the more interesting part of the story is the second half, is that what happened subsequently and how my sort of experience of climbing has led me to, have four more children, we're still married, I've led a very successful, fulfilling life, and I feel better now than I have, for a very long time. And I count that as a story of recovery. I think that's a story of hope. Hope that things can get better. Hope that you're not just defined by what happened to you, but by what could happen next. And that's a really exciting and positive story, I think, much more so than just the trauma that happened. That's only the first half.
Amazing, Rich. Thank you so much for sharing this with us and your passion for, well, pretty much transforming the landscape of healthcare. I mean, is that too grand a thing to put on your shoulders?
It might be a bit big. Transforming part of the landscape of healthcare.
There you go. Just the Ogwin Valley of healthcare. There you go. Okay, we're going to finish with our quick fire questions. These are 10 questions we ask every guest on Finding Our Way. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay, describe yourself in 3 words.
Passionate, committed and curious.
What is your favourite mountain or crag snack?
Bread pudding.
Ooh, interesting. Best mountain memory?
Guiding my best mate up Mont Blanc in 2009.
Bucket list destination?
Is it the Kulin Traverse?
Ooh, yes, that's on my too. How often do you get lost, Rich?
I've been genuinely lost 3 times in my life. Unpleasant.
Are you funny?
I think people would say that about me, yes.
If you were an animal, what animal would you be?
I've always loved the peregrine falcon.
One thing that you always carry on the hill or to the crag?
Compass.
What does climbing and mountaineering mean to you?
Connection.
And lastly, we want more of you. Where should we go?
If you want to get in touch with me, I'm on Twitter at lchipmeister. If you want to get in touch with the Nottingham Community Voluntary Services, Green Space, they're on the web at nottinghamcvs.co.uk/greenspace. And if you're interested in the Peer Leadership Development Programme, the email address is england.pldp@nhs.net.
Okay, and folks, if you want any of those details or links to the books and TED Talks that Rich mentioned earlier, we'll have those in the show notes. So go to the BMC website and you'll have all that information there. Thank you, Rich. Thank you so much. And good luck with the projects in the future.
Thank you so much.
Thank you also for listening. Let's grow this thing. Subscribe so you don't miss an episode. Share the podcast with your friends. And do please let us know what you think. Use @TeamBMC on Instagram and Twitter and #FindingOurWay. I'll see you on the next one. Goodbye.
Finding Our Way is brought to you by the British Mountaineering Council and is kindly supported by Berghaus. This episode was produced and hosted by me, Mary Anne O'Hotter, and edited and mixed by Chris Stone.